Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Of course, this is part two of this week's Q&A with Layla. It's an opportunity for you to post questions to us collectively, just the way that patients do at the Hoffman Center on a daily basis. And so take it away, Layla. What's our next question?
Okay. This next one comes from Mary Lou. Hi, Dr. Hoffman. I just came from my doctor's office with my cholesterol results, and the doctor said it's high. I'm 69 years old. Her total cholesterol is 314. Her LDL is 169. Her HDL is 134. And her triglycerides are a beautiful 55.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Mary Lou says she's incorporated virgin coconut oil into her daily diet, and she just knows that that's what raised all of her numbers.
Mm-hmm.
Should she be worried? Well, Mary Lou, there is evidence to suggest there was a comparison of coconut oil with soybean oil.
Mm-hmm.
And soybean oil was actually the one that raised LDL, which is what would be of concern to any doctor or practitioner.
Right.
However,
so what we see, by the way, what we see in her case, it's quite remarkable because her cholesterol, no question, it's sky high. It's over 300. However, her HDL is one of the highest that I've ever seen. I don't think I've seen, you know, maybe more than a handful of people who have HDL that's that high.
But you know what I found out in the literature is that coconut oil has been shown to raise significantly HDL.
Well, that's fabulous. That's generally good. Yeah. And so here's the deal. This may not be a problem at all.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
But
the total number doesn't really mean anything.
Right. But we can't be sure.
Right.
So how do we deal with cases like this? Almost every week I have a patient or two who has precisely this dilemma. They want a second opinion on whether they need to go on statins because doctors will routinely and reflexively put patients on statins if they have high cholesterol, believing that that's going to be beneficial. Well, if you have very little risk, then your potential for having an adverse effect becomes greater than your potential for getting a benefit. So the risk-benefit equation tilts towards avoidance of a statin. And the tiebreaker on that, as you know, Layla, is we send patients for EBT heart scans, which can indicate the degree of plaque formation. Now, we have some surprises sometimes. Sometimes we'll see someone where we suspect that they have very little plaque and they'll be loaded. They'll have a score in several hundreds. And alternatively, we may have people where they have very high cholesterol. We have many patients.
300s, like Mary Lou.
Yeah, we have many patients with cholesterol in the 300s, and we give them the good news that they have zero plaque.
Yeah.
And that means.
So this is a real conundrum.
Yeah, yeah. But it's easily solvable. And, you know, I had a patient come in the other day. It was very interesting because this is a longtime patient. I think I've been treating him for, you know, 15 years or something. And I recommended a long time ago that he get an EBT heart scan. And he got one in 2008. And he came back to me. He said, hey, you know, when you first suggested that test to me, I wasn't sure, but I went along with it. You know, it sounded a little weird. My doctor said there's no need for that test. But now, you know, when I talk to my doctors about this, they say, yeah, go get an, you know, get an EBT heart. And he said, I already did. And score, of course, was zero.
You're ahead of your time.
Yeah. So I feel good about that. Yeah. So we're right on some things, not right on everything, but that's one of the things that we predicted, the trend towards non-invasive scanning to predict cardiovascular risk, because you can't depend on the cholesterol scores. You can't even depend on, all these things like C-reactive protein, LP little a. These all add up to the potential for risk, but the actual risk you can spot by looking into the arteries. Now, is it 100% impossible to have a heart attack if you have a zero score? It's almost impossible. I mean, I guess there are cases where people could have tremendous stress and go into coronary spasm with no visible plaque, but very rarely. And there's a pretty good correlation between the degree of plaque and your risk of cardiovascular events. And you know who figured this out? It's a guy named Agatson. Does that name sound familiar?
Oh, yeah. South Beach Diet.
The South Beach Diet guy.
Right.
He's actually the guy who devised this whole means of testing.
Yeah, that's right. Arthur Agatson.
Right, Arthur Agatson. Not entirely satisfied with his dietary approach.
No.
because it's a lower carb approach, but it's also a low fat approach. And
exactly.
I think that's where he kind of missed the boat
and
a little bit.
And he's veered off into too many products at this point.
So oh.
You have to wonder about nutritional quality. And
he didn't make enough money with the EBT yeah. scanning thing? I don't know.
Well, he's on a roll. Who knows?
Okay. He's a mover and a shaker kind of guy. Okay.
Right.
So, and the books, I mean, the books sold like hotcakes.
That's true.
That's a great title.
That's true. Yeah. Yeah. Well, another question I have, I would predict that with Mary Lou's triglycerides of 55, that she probably doesn't take in many carbohydrates at all. So I would predict, I wouldn't gamble on it, but I would predict that she would have a large pattern A LDL.
Yeah. And that's the other thing we can do.
Does.
And the other
mm-hmm.
thing we can do is, right, we can do something that's sometimes referred to as the VAPS test or the lipoprotein
NMR.
Fractionation or NMR, the various names for it. It's LDL, slicing and dicing the LDL to see if it's the good LDL or the not-so-good LDL. And then you can determine if it's pattern A, which is good, or pattern B, which is bad, or intermediate A/B. And you can even do that with HDL. There's actually some people who come up with they have an okay LDL, but it's not good quality LDL. I'm sorry,
yeah.
HDL. HDL.
HDL.
In other words,
mm-hmm.
we tend to think of HDL as being, it's all good.
Just the good guy, yeah.
Yeah, but it's some of HDL is less good. So we can actually break down the HDL, and that has some predictive value. So there's, more testing can be done. And then we can also look at whether the LDL is oxidized, because that's important too. Is if your LDL is unoxidized, it's more benign. If it's oxidized, it forms creates a free radical attack on your arterial walls, damages the endothelium, and sets the stage for atherosclerosis, calcification, and plaque.
Yeah.
So there you have it.
So, Mary Lou, follow up on all of these, and I would continue your coconut oil, your virgin coconut oil.
Because it's going to help your brain.
It's just good for you. Yeah.
It's going to help the brain, too.
Yeah. Definitely.
And by the way, a saturated fat that was thought to be anathema. There was a whole campaign that was launched by a guy named Sokolov in the 1980s. He took up full-page ads in the Times and the Wall Street Journal decrying tropical oils. He was a millionaire guy, and he just got off on the wrong foot. And so many companies dropped their use of tropical oils and substituted hydrogenated fat in the products that needed a kind of a lard-like consistency. By the way, speaking of saturated fat, talk about a turnaround. There's an article in the Times today, which is, let's see if I could get it here. It has to do with the repopularization of schmaltz. Do you know what schmaltz is? Chicken fat.
Oh, okay.
Is that is that in light of recent findings, chicken fat turns out not to be so bad for you?
Yeah. Well, there you go.
Okay.
The same must be for duck fat.
Right.
Animal fat, tallow, all of that stuff, it's okay to have. That's what we found out.
I tell you, if not for chicken fat, I don't think I would be alive, because that's how my ancestors survived. And I remember my grandmother and my grandfather would take like a piece of dark bread, and they literally would smear like a big glob of chicken fat on that. And that was, they considered that a delicacy. Or they would make something called gribbinus, which is fried chicken skin in lard. And that was like, I guess they also have
that's
this.
It's like chitlins.
It's like chitlins.
That's done with pork.
Yes, pork exactly.
Skin.
It's every culture has this. I mean, the Jews didn't learn this from the Deep South. They learned it in Europe. And in Puerto Rico, they have something called chicharrón. Which is fried pork rinds. Chicharron, which is, when you're on a subsistence diet, and you don't throw away all that good stuff from
the
chicken.
And apparently it's been good for us all along.
I think Jews in Eastern Europe use chickens the way that the Native Americans use buffaloes. They use the whole chicken, every part of the chicken. They didn't throw any part away. They just were very, very ecological about it. It's like everything was, I mean, they
Nose-to-tail eating. Yeah.
Nose-to-tail eating, and then they would
take the bones and make... Well, nose-to-tail eating is coming back in vogue.
And bone broth? You know, you take
bone
the...
Bone broth, yes.
That's what I did the other day. I got a... I got a takeout chicken. It was an organic chicken, but it was a takeout chicken. I was in a hurry. But what I did is I saved the bones. I threw it into a... I had a crock pot. Yeah. And I usually make my hot cereal in there, but this, you know, I had already made my hot cereal. I threw the bones in there, covered it with water. I warmed it up overnight and had a beautiful broth that I then, I had some squash and I chopped the squash into there and added it to the broth, put some seasoning in, like a little bit of cinnamon because I wanted a little sweeter, you know, part of the sweet spice flavor to that. It's sweet enough, you know, with the butternut squash. And then I had one of these propeller blenders that you can stick in the soup.
Yeah,
and it's great because
it's
an immersion blender, and it made like a smooth butternut squash soup, which was, you know, I felt good because I was...
Bulletproof soup.
I was conserving the goodness from the chicken bones because you don't throw that stuff away.
No, you don't throw that stuff away, and it's an excellent source of calcium.
So,
how they got calcium, right?
So I got the leftovers in my refrigerator. If I need a quick pick me up, I've got it there.
There you go.
So there you go. All right. I just talk about this stuff. I don't take out food from. Chinese restaurants menus, and neither do you. You're bringing your lunch every day. Now that's
every day I bring my lunch.
Okay,
because I like my food.
What did you have for lunch today?
Today I had most days I have a salad, and I had some chicken salad.
Okay.
Yeah, that my husband made with some very nice mayonnaise. He puts dill in it, a little salt and pepper, organic chicken breast, and it's just delicious. And
he's a real catch because he could fix everything in your house because he's a contractor.
And he cooks.
It doesn't get any better than that. Okay. Send your request to radioprogram@AOL.com to Layla to ask her where she finds guys like that. You know, maybe there are more guys like that. There's not too many guys like that in New York.
Yeah.
Who are single. Okay. Next question
comes from Kalau Peru from Lewis.
Wow, that's so cool. Because we have an Australia question, now we have a Peruvian question.
Here we go.
Awesome.
Please, Lewis says, please, if you could tell us, what is the treatment for ophthalmic pain from herpes zoster?
Oh.
Yay.
Okay. You know, I tell you, that's a rough one. I do get questions about post-herpetic neuralgia.
Yeah.
And I got to say that the best treatment is prevention, number one, and that's through bolstering your immune system so you don't get shingles. I think the shingles is the result of a glitch in your immune response. And that, you know, look, we all go through stress, and sometimes we're not eating perfectly, and we might get low in vitamin D. There's nutritional strategies for bolstering your immunity to prevent it. There's the vaccine. I'm not entirely convinced that the vaccine offers that much advantage in terms of the ultimate dread outcome, which is the post-herpetic neuralgia. Their studies are back and forth on that, although a recent study showed that not only did it reduce the incidence of shingles episodes, but that it reduced the likelihood that if you got one, you would get post-herpetic neuralgia. But what I like to do is, we let our patients know if they have a problem, they can call us and they can come in quickly for intravenous vitamin C. And I've actually really saved some patients from very debilitating...
Dr. Hoffman, did you just say that people have gotten the neuralgia pain from the vaccine?
Well, no, I didn't, but I won't say that the vaccine causes the problem, but hey, it's a live vaccine. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the concern is that, you have to be careful when you administer the vaccine, because if you're around someone who has not been vaccinated, you could actually transmit chickenpox. So that's one of the drawbacks of the vaccine, is that it's a live vaccine.
Oh, wow. All right. So anyway, best of luck to Lewis. Wow. All right.
Yeah. The conventional management, unfortunately, is using various types of painkillers, using things that help nerve pain like Neurontin, These are agents which suppress nerve pain. Nerve pain is very, very tough to treat, though. You actually sometimes have to use antidepressant medication, opiates. It's terrible. I mean, and in the eye, think of all the nerves that are in the eye. That's a bad one. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, best of luck to Lewis.
Yep.
Our next question is from Kevin. And do you have any solution for Achilles tendonitis? Several months of therapy and stretching have not cured the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Anytime I walk a significant amount, I get a flare-up.
Yeah.
Many thanks.
Okay, so with tendonitis, there actually are some studies that show that curcumin is specifically helpful for tendonitis. And, you know, we like the Mareva brand of curcumin. Look it up. You can find it on our website at drhoffman.com, as well as many of the products that we talk about here in this podcast. In addition, I would use a lot of essential fatty acids, omega-3 fatty acids. If you have an inflammatory problem, sometimes it's helpful to really go full court press on Wobenzym, which is an anti-inflammatory that's popular in Europe for sports injuries. Maybe take three or four, three times daily between meals, away from food. And
so it doesn't digest your food.
Right. It's a proteolytic enzyme. It breaks up some of these complexes that form where there's injury.
Yeah.
And it's got a pretty, bromelain is an anti-swelling agent, so that's helpful. You may want to use something like pycnogenol to boost the effect of the Wobenzym, because pycnogenol is a potent bioflavonoid that reduces swelling. And, I don't know what kind of overall condition this person's in. You know, maybe there are other factors. Overweight could be an issue. Maybe this person's in an overall pro-inflammatory state because of insulin resistance, metabolic syndrome. You know, just getting really, you know, cleaning up your act altogether. Perhaps vitamin D for healing. Vitamin D is sometimes helpful for pain, helpful for wound repair. Vitamin C, zinc, you know.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah,
best of luck to Kevin.
And I've had these injuries, and they can be very tenacious. And, I've worked my way through
plantar fasciitis.
I've worked my way through not quite Achilles tendonitis, but quadriceps tendonitis. You know, it's because as a runner and an athlete, you know, that's going to happen. And, you know, it's sort of like the over 50 rule. It's always something. especially if you're active. You have something to look forward to. You have something to look forward to. Because it's, you know, and you kind of have to, you know, roll with it because, you know, you're going to have some stuff, and then you have to kind of cope with it. And maybe, you know, you need acupuncture, physical therapy, massage, deep tissue massage. There's some ways to release that tight muscle, perhaps through some kind of body work as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we have time for one more question.
Great. And this actually goes back to President Obama with the subject of GERD a little bit. This comes from Dennis.
Okay.
I was diagnosed with GERD and heartburn and given omeprazole.
Wait a minute. Dennis is not from some weird foreign country?
No.
Oh.
No,
but
this is just Dennis. And
boring.
We don't know where he's from.
Boring. Okay. Oh, it's all right. That's all right, Dennis. It's okay if you're an American.
So he's been given omeprazole. And on the warning, it says, and he quotes, "This medication may rarely cause C. difficile."
Oh, yeah.
Which warmed my heart, Dennis.
Right.
I've also read that it's not acid, but the lack of acid.
Right.
That's the problem.
Right.
And that, you know, what you should take are things like DGL, like Endothen. He says calcium citrate, but I think calcium would only irritate further. What is your view, and what do you recommend?
If you're going to use a calcium, you use calcium carbonate, because that's Tums, basically. That's the old-fashioned thing with Tums. The only problem with that is if you chew lots and lots of Tums, you can develop something called milk alkali syndrome, which is excess calcium resulting in kidney stones.
Oh.
And before the advent of these acid-blocking medications, remember there was a time when there weren't any acid-blocking medications, even before Nexium and Protonix. There was at least Pepcid, you know, medications like that, Tagamet. But before that, people just chewed a lot of antacids, many of which were calcium based, and they got kidney stones. Or else, if that didn't work, they would take out your stomach. We used to do lots and lots of gastric surgery for ulcers. Now, thank goodness for the surgeons. They're doing lots and lots of gastric surgery for, you know what, for bypass, for weight loss.
Oh, yes. Because otherwise, that's right.
Otherwise, those surgeons would have had no business. You know, the new acid blocking medication almost put them out of business. Anyway, so yeah, the medication can cause C. difficile. Why? Because it disturbs the gastrointestinal flora by changing the acidity in the gastrointestinal tract, and that is a serious consideration. And you know, another just short of if whether or not you get C. difficile, think of all those people on those cruise ships. Or people going, you know, when people have a little money and they retire at 70 or so, they go to these exotic places. And such a high percentage of them by that age are on acid blocking medication for the rest of their lives. And those are the people who probably have, you know, three or four times the risk of developing some sort of Montezuma's revenge or some sort of, gastrointestinal infection while on a cruise ship.
Right. And all those buffets on a cruise ship, which are 24/7, only adds to the problem.
Exactly. It's a perfect storm, you know.
Yeah.
So, plenty of alcohol, desserts, you know, that whole thing.
Right.
So, So the question is, you know, what do you do? Well,
BGL, Endofen.
And you try and wean off as soon as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Because sometimes we actually do tell patients, look, it turns out, they have an ulcer. They have really severe inflammation. They really have to put out the fire by taking an acid-blocking medication. But we'd like them to do that for no longer than about 60 days, at which point we'd like to wean them very gradually, because by then the diet modification suggestions and the DGL and the endofen should be kicking in. It takes a while for those to work. And then you can pull away the trainer wheels, and then patients can fly free of acid-blocking medication.
Mm-hmm.
Probiotics, I think, also have a place to play in that role to play.
Yes.
Because they can help to repopulate the gastrointestinal tract with good bacteria. That's not 100%, but that's somewhat of a protection. We might even suggest that patients concerned about C. difficile take Saccharomyces, which is known to have a preventive effect against C. difficile. That's a type of probiotic. Brand name is Florastor, but we also have Saccharomyces on our dispensary at drhoffman.com.
So it's also great if you're taking an antibiotic to prevent C. difficile.
Right, right. So, I think, and, you know, not, let's mention also other side effects. There's a higher risk of community-acquired pneumonia in those people. There's a higher risk of osteoporosis. There's a higher risk of B12 deficiency. There's a higher risk of magnesium deficiency. Mm-hmm. So overall, it's just not good to, you know, probably tens of millions of Americans who are permanently consigned to acid-blocking medication for the rest of their lives. And that is, that's not good.
It's not good, no. Oh, best of luck to Dennis then. All right.
Yep. All right. So that's all she wrote for. But let's mention fish oil, too, because fish oil has a role to play in healing. You know, that's one of the things we want to give, you know, because it actually coats the gastrointestinal tract, reduces inflammation, can be good. Zinc carnosine is one of the things we might suggest as well.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it. All right. That's all the time we have for today's edition of Q&A with Layla. But if you haven't had your question answered, keep on listening, because we have a little bit of a backlog of questions. We'll get to them over Christmas, because we will continue to broadcast right through the holidays. We promise to answer as many questions as we can. And those of you who are stressed by the holidays, check out my two-part article on surviving the holidays, because we've got some practical tips on what you can do to make it through to the bowl games intact. Because otherwise you may wake up on January 2nd and say, I can't believe I ate the whole thing, you know.
Well, isn't that an Alka-Seltzer commercial?
That's an Alka-Seltzer commercial. Yeah. Yes, but, you know, only you and I know that, because I think that dates us.
Yeah.
Maybe some of our listeners remember that. All right. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.